From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Fereydoun Nasiri will celebrate his 82nd birthday in March. He is a Wilmington resident and business owner who escaped to the United States almost 40 years ago from the second largest country in the Middle East, Iran. In the 1960s, Nasiri began his career with the Iranian government. But when the regime of the Shah fell during the Iranian Revolution in 1979, Nasiri found himself a political prisoner. Today, the man widely known in the Cape Fear region as Fred Nasiri, owner of the Gallery of Oriental Rugs in Wilmington, will tell us his story and explore the changes that he's observed in his country of origin over the last several decades. He joins me now. Fred Nasiri, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much for inviting me to share some of my experiences with you and your audience.
And I do want to say quickly, full disclosure, the Gallery of Oriental Rugs has been a longtime underwriter of WHQR. And of course, that is not why we are having you on the air. You have an incredible story. Before we get into your upbringing in Iran and your education as a lawyer, tell me, have you ever been back to Iran since you fled?
Unfortunately, I cannot, and I have never been there.
And it wouldn't be safe for you to go back?
At all.
What was it like? Your father was a lawyer, and you were born and raised there and eventually went on to become a lawyer yourself. What was your education like in Iran? What was the culture like?
Well, the education was very good. My father always emphasized on the importance of education, and we are three brothers, and all of us, we are highly educated. He wanted me as older son to be lawyer. And two other brothers are engineers. One of them graduated from Stanford in structural engineer, PhD, living in Los Angeles, in charge of the County of Los Angeles Water Management. The other one went to Imperial College in England, has PhD in structural engineer, is working in Canada in charge of the building and designing the platform for oil exploration. And I went to France. Get a law degree from France. I went to Sorbonne, then I went to University of Toulouse. And when I came back, my father was very happy to have me to work with him as a lawyer.
What was it like? So you were born in the 1930s, so your childhood would have been in the 1940s in Iran. What kinds of access to culture did you have? What kinds of things, that, you know, art and music and that sort of thing in Iran back then?
Well, my father was a very prominent lawyer, and his hobby was collecting of a very fine Persian rug. And it is quite interesting that after all of these years, now I am ending up to be really a patron of the arts here and having a gallery of Oriental rugs with my wife. It was a very quiet country. We didn't have resources there. We didn't get as much money. The money that we get from oil was very minimum. It was about $1 per barrel of oil, and you know this was. And also, we were considered as developing nations. You know, we get some assistance from other countries, including United States. You know, we were under the supervision of the AID, that they give us every year some loans to build roads, build a school. The life was quite quiet. And Iran has several changes. In 1953, there was a revolution in Iran, to some extent, uprising against the British Petroleum. And I think we had a prime minister, Mossadegh, who did nationalize Iranian oil. Of course, and I was a student at that time in the high school. I was a good basketball player. I was the captain of the team of basketball.
The captain of the basketball team.
in Isfahan. And then I worked with the city. And then I went to the school of law school in Tehran. I played in university as well. And this was really, you know, my sports side. But there were lots of music, culture. You know, Iranian, they love art. They love life. You know, When you talk about Iran, you need to separate always the people of Iran from the rulers of Iran. Iranian people are people who really love arts, poetry, and their contribution to the civilization of the world is enormous in astronomy, in medicine, in philosophy, and they were always very civilized people. They were never invaded other people.
What do you think the perception is in America right now? Because we talked a little bit before this show started, and you've said that a couple of times, that Americans, when they think about Iran and the people of Iran, they need to separate their perceptions from that of the Iranian government.
But unfortunately, sometimes they have a very quick judgment when they look at negative news about Iran. They immediately, whenever they see an Iranian, say, damn Iranian, you know, attack them. But this is not everybody, you know. At the same time, you know, in the business that I am and the people that I know and I'm in contact, they're all cultured, successful, you know, they know. And I tried my best also to tell them that, you know, Iranian people are different from the rulers. And you saw, after 9/11, there are about thousands of Iranian students and they're showing their sympathy toward America with candor. No country in Middle East did that one. This time, when the airplane came down, a Ukrainian airplane came down, the Iranian, they came out and they expressed themselves. Therefore, they love peace. They love, they are very civil in their behavior. They are not terrorists. Have you seen any Iranian who blow himself anywhere in the world? Oh, we don't see them. Maybe exception, you might see them. But unfortunately, you know, you have to prove yourself. You know, for example, I always tell people, sometimes they talk about America. I said to our American friends, I said, you are the luckiest person in the world. You have a gift that nobody in the world has as good as you have, because I feel it, but those who have been born in this country, they don't feel it, and it's freedom. Mm-hmm. And I am so blessed, and my family, to be American, to enjoy the opportunities here. Of course, when people, they see me with my accent or somebody with a different color, they might differently put a pause. But then if you prove yourself that's a good person, you are positive, you are contributing to the society, then they accept you.
And you actually were born into a family and into a time in Iran when you did have a certain amount of freedom. Educated in France, you said you went to the Sorbonne and Toulouse. And
yes.
Then you came back to Iran in 1962 to practice as a lawyer. What did you expect to do? What kind of specialty was your father involved in?
This is very natural that all the, when you graduate from university, you have so much idea. You're very idealistic, you know.
What did you think you were going to do?
I was changing a lot of things, changing educational system, I was writing articles for the newspaper. I was a good writer at that time, you know, and I was trying to do this because I was enjoying this. You know, I was thinking there are so many things wrong in the country, I can fix it. And then when you get to position that you are responsible, you see that it's not that easy. Always when you are a student, you are a scholar, you have so much idea about, you know, fixing the thing, making the things look better, create a utopia. But then when you come to practice to do it, you see that it's not that easy.
So then how did you go, Fred Nasiri, from being a lawyer, a young idealistic lawyer, fresh from an education in France, to working in the Shah's regime in the Iranian government?
Well, I was very positive and contributor to the government because I was an expert, I was knowledgeable, and I was very active. I was a diplomat in Washington, D.C. I worked directly with Mr. McNamara at that time, who was the president of the World Bank. I was responsible to negotiate majority of the loans that Iran was getting from World Bank and Exim Bank. And when I get back, I was deputy minister of labor. I was very restrict on my job. I was going by the rule. I was not corrupt. I was giving always the best advice to the government. I was always traveling to other countries to see what they do. I remember we wanted to accept workers to Iran, because Iran in 73, 74, we did a shortage of labor. And then I said that I heard that Germany is one of the best country to learn from them. I went to Germany. I learned how they are getting the guest workers. We established a wonderful system.
You established a guest worker program
in Iran. And, you know, I hired 5,000 doctors from India, 2,000 technicians from Korea, 3,000 nurses from Philippines, 1 million workers from Afghanistan. All of them, when they come to the country, they have ID, they picture. Not like here, that everybody can come here, you know. I'm believing that, you know, we have to have a system. And it's easy to do that. I don't know why they don't do it here.
Well, maybe that's something you could consult with the American government on.
I am available. I'm available to tell them what we did in Iran at work.
And so at the time, during the peak of the Shah's regime, he was a popular person with Western governments, and there seemed to be a lot of synergy happening, and he was interested in growing Iran, certainly economically, and westernizing, and there were some ideals there that you supported, like expanding the role of women in government, for instance. How did you... Well, I'll ask you that question when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. Fred Nasiri is my guest today. We will also find out when we come back from this break how he escaped from an Iranian prison. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Fred Nasiri is a longtime Wilmington resident and the owner of the Gallery of Oriental Rugs, which is an underwriter of WHQR. Raised in Iran, he worked for the Shah before finding himself a political prisoner. We're about to find out how he wound up in an Iranian prison and how and why he found his way to Wilmington, North Carolina. But first, just before we went to break, you were about to explain, before the downfall of the Shah's regime, why he became such a popular figure with Western governments, including the United States. What was it about him?
Well, first of all, he was very civil. You know, his relationship was very balanced with the Western, and he was working with them. Of course, Iran, I am sure that you remember that when all the Arab nations, they put embargo on exporting oil to America, Shah was the only person, only country, Iran was only country who provided oil to America and to the Western countries. He was not really aggressive as far as the Western power. He was doing a lot of businesses with. He created a balance. He was dealing business with France, with Central Europe, with England, with United States, with Russia, with China. He was not really. Of course, he was always worried about Russia, but he was always doing business with all of this country, and I personally think that he, maybe because the fact that he was sick and we didn't know, he knew that he had a cancer, he was expressing to push the country too fast, too far. And even I remember we had a meeting in Ramsar with him about planning, and we told him, many people, they told him that the country cannot absorb $20 billion extra dollars. Because we had $4 billion from oil. Suddenly the income from get to $20 billion. But he said, no, I would like to force the country to go. This is when he assigned me to go bring workers to do everything, to build a shipyard, ship port for us, to build the airport for us, to build the road for us, because we didn't have
enough. You didn't have any of this infrastructure for
this level of commerce. No, not enough. We had trucks coming from to America. We didn't have drivers. And I purchased 200 mobile training center, traveling from village to village, training bricklayer, welder in 6 months, 7 months, and go from this village to this village, this town to this town. This is intensive training people. Of course, he liked my idea because he had a problem. I told him this is what I would suggest. And he was very open to this. However, he would not listen to everybody else. It was his way or highway.
But you're saying the cancer was actually driving the level of urgency that was there.
He wanted during the time that he had, he was alive, he wants to get to maximum growth of the country. And this really, at the same time, when you inject $20 billion to a country which used to have $24 billion, you create problem for corruption, you create inflation, you create, resentment of the people. Yeah, this was, he was going too fast, too fast modernizing the country.
And
country
was
not ready.
He was a pretty autocratic ruler.
He was.
He engaged in arrests and torture by his secret police. There were all kinds of human rights abuses as a result of his administration.
I do not want to tell him that, he was not responsible for these, but he was not responsible for all of them. Because then there were so many people who were working in Iran in those departments of Savak and other people, they were really doing on their own to show that it's service to you. But I personally think the same way maybe in Iran, for example, the supreme leader of Iran told Mr. Soleimani to go and do that job, but he didn't tell him to kill 10,000 people, 5,000 people, or 2,000 people. He killed or killed some. But unfortunately, some of these organizations, which was under the Shah, was doing on their own. And I am sure about that, and I know about that, and I have documentation that some of these companies, like Savak, it was not all of the thing that we're doing with approval of the Shah.
How well did you know the Shah personally? How often did you see him in a one-on-one kind of situation?
I saw him at least maybe 50, 60 times during the time that I was in the government. And one thing I will tell you about him, that he loved Iran. He loved the country. He loved the history and culture of Iran. And even, for example, one time he called me after the Vietnam War, he said, you have to go to America and hire 500 Vietnam refugees because Americans are down. We need to show our friendship to them. He was really a type of person. He would love, but at the same time, he was autocrat. He was a dictator. I think during his reign, many people, they have been tortured. Many people, they have been killed. But I would say that, we should not blame all of the to him.
All of the atrocities are not the responsibility of the Shah, you're saying.
Some of these people under him, they were doing this thing without even telling him.
You know, it's hard sometimes to kind of address that built-in paradox of somebody who is, at least on the surface, championing women's rights, for instance, trying to get women more involved in government and commerce and all aspects of the country, driving. And at the same time, think about this sort of autocratic secret police torture and imprisonment of people for political reasons, crushing any kind of dissension. How do you put that together in your head? How do you reconcile that?
Well, I'm not going to approve that, and I'm not saying what he did or as far as that part is good, but he did a lot of positive things, like so say women's rights, one participation of the workers in the profit of the factories, for example, land reform, Peace Corps. He sent people to educate people in the villages. He did so many positive things. In fact, he was calling it White Revolution. And this old principle. At the same time, you know, yes, of course, there were some people who were against him. There were some movement, for example, Islamic movement. There are some communist movement. There are some communists from China, communists from Russia, communists from European. And then he was fighting with them at the same time. And I would say that some of the things which happened in Iran, I don't approve it. But I would not blame all of this on him.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with Fred Nasiri, Iranian-American, Wilmington resident and owner of the Gallery of Oriental Rugs, an underwriter, full disclosure, of WHQR. At what point did you see the Iranian Revolution begin to affect the Shah's regime? It started in 1978.
Well, yes, in fact. Of course, it's a very long conversation to get to this one. Of course, I don't want to blame oil as one of the reasons of the collapse of the Shah. But there are so many elements were involved. You know, President Carter was a major player in the collapse of the regime of the Shah. I think oil companies, they were a big major. There is a book which is about crash of 1969, which wrote in 1967. And he talked about, for example, Shah said, I'm not going to renew the oil agreement with consortium in 1969. But at the same time, you know, in 1960, when President Carter came to power, he said some of the Iranian students in America, they went to him or to his allies and to his colleagues and told him that, you know, Shah is doing that and President Carter frankly said, you know, we cannot tolerate, you know, the regime like a Shah. Of course, he came to Iran and he was guest of Shah in the January, and he says this is the island of the peace in Iran, and Shah was stabilizing the peace in Middle East because of his presence and because he was very powerful army. But I was seeing in 1968, because I was a member of the High Council of Economic Affairs. This is a council that only six senior ministers are in that one. And I was participating on this one every week with Prime Minister. I was seeing them. I was seeing his health is declining. I was seeing there are all these, you know, media, you know, BBC, Voice of America, newspapers, everybody writing the negative article about the Shah. And there were some demonstration. Then during the mosque, there were amazing publicity against him. Of course, Khomeini started to became like a leader of the revolution. And, you know, I was seeing him in 1968, but I was never thought that this will lead to the collapse of the regime, because we didn't know.
You didn't think 10 years earlier it was possible that Khomeini would...
No, in fact, in 19... I think the whole movement started in 1978. On the beginning of 1978, you will see these things happen. You know, the government, you know,
it changed. What started to change in your life? Like, how did you, I mean, certainly you were privy to some of the dialogue inside the government that members of the public wouldn't have been privy to. But what could members of the public see happening? What was changing in the country at that point?
I think one of the biggest things that I will see, and I really have to say that was the maybe one of the elements of the collapse, was corruption. Corruption and also autonomy of many people who were really in Savak and in the government. They were corrupt and they were making decisions on their own. They would not give for every decision, get the permission from the Shah. And Shah is starting to lose it.
He's very sick at this point, too, with cancer.
Very sick and lose it. And, you know, he became weak and he put the wrong prime ministers in charge. You know, he changed the prime minister after prime ministers. And it lost the control.
But at some point, before the whole government fell, you got your wife and kids out of the country.
Yes.
Why did you do that? What did you see coming? What happened?
Well, in September of 1978, I see the schools are closing. And, you know, I have three children, and they were always, you know, demonstration. Every day there was strike, and I saw it is not healthy for the children. I'm about to stay there. I sent them to London to stay with my brother-in-law. My brother-in-law or her brother.
Now, you say you did that because the schools closed. Everybody was on strike. But did you think that this was really going to be the fall of the Shah at that point? Did you think that you were sending them to safety? Did
no,
you know the, no, the no, breadth maybe, of what maybe, was going to happen?
No, maybe I was a wishful thinker. No, I would not, because especially when Shah assigned a prime minister who was opposing him, and he was Mr. Bakhtiar, Shapur Bakhtiar became prime, and at that time, I was acting managing director of Plan and Budget Organization. This man was on the other side, and we were hoping that maybe some of the liberals, some of the people who really educated people, they are going to support him. And they did to some extent, but the movement of Khomeini was so powerful, and you know, and the militia, and also many of the warrior from Palestinian, they came to Iran. I was seeing them in Iran when I was really in January of when Shah left in January of 1979. I was seeing Palestinian that speaking Arabic. They were in the streets of Tehran. Therefore, they come. Many of them were trained in the camp of Yasser Arafat. They came to Iran, and they were helping to go. And then Mr. President Carter, he sent General Heiser to Iran to tell to the military officers and the generals of Iran that you have to stay apart, be neutral. And the military, the army said, we will not support anybody. We are just stay in our base. I think we saw that everything collapsing, and then that was the sign. But I had to stay. I couldn't escape from Iran at that time.
If you could have escaped, would you have gone at that point? Did you know that you were then in danger?
Yes, I would see I'm in danger, but I didn't want to leave that my position.
So your wife and your kids, your three kids, are in London with your brother-in-law, and at some point, they wind up in Arkansas. But you, how long after the fall of the Shah did it take for them to put you under house arrest and then put you
immediately. Yes. But I was seeing it happening because, you know, Bakhtiar, because even when I went to Bakhtiar, I was seeing he was very nervous. We had meeting with him every week, and the general would not listen to him. In fact, there was a general who was head of the army would not listen to him. They said General Heiser told them from America that, you know, don't interfere in the affairs of revolution. Therefore, we knew that his hand is empty. He couldn't do anything. And then we see the militaries, the bases were collapsing. People are leaving, the soldiers are leaving the base, you know, they go to their villages, but yes, of course, if I was thinking about myself and not about the country, because I love my country, and I didn't know reason to escape from Iran, because I knew that even if the country collapsed, I am a technocrat. I know about the country. I could still live in country and work in the country for the private sector. I don't know. Even Bazargan, the prime minister of Khomeini, he told me that we need you because we don't know how to run the government.
And so it never occurred to you that they would change and decide that you were a threat and that you needed to be in prison.
Because I didn't do nothing wrong.
Tell us
people who were corrupt, yes, of course, they had to escape.
Tell us about the day that you were put under house arrest.
I think for the first 2 weeks, 3 weeks of the revolution, nothing. But beginning of March, we saw that, you know, they made a declaration that all the government officials are in house arrest. And then they came 1 year later and took me for questioning, and that was end of my walking in the street. Therefore, I was in prison, and they started to question me, and then I was watching the execution after execution after execution. And
what was the prison like that you were in?
Prison was not bad, We were, for example, in a room of that size. We had about 16 people staying this way and that way, sleeping. We had not a good food. They were always trying to give us hard time. For example, when there was a time for taking shower, they put the hot water first, and then they immediately turned it to the cold. And they were these type of stupid things they were doing to give us the hard time. And I saw over there so many generals, so many ministers, so many of my old friends, people who were senior to me, junior to me, and they were executing them right and left. Therefore, that time was really as a horrible time. Therefore, when they let me out of prison temporarily, I said, that's not my country anymore. You know, I am not going to stay anymore, because I knew that next time they take me there, they are going to kill me.
You were actually in prison for a couple of years?
No, 6 months.
6 months you were in prison?
Yeah, 6 months.
So under house arrest for about a year?
More than a year. From the beginning of 1979 until 1980, February of 1981.
And while you're in prison, people are getting taken to court on a regular basis.
Yes, ma'am.
And in court, there people are separated into two groups after the day is over.
That's correct.
And one group goes to the right.
And one group to the left. The left are their case has not been decided yet. The right, their case has been decided. Their execution.
You're listening to Coastline. Fred Nasiri is with us today. We will be back after this 90-second break. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Fred Nasiri was born Fereydoon Nasiri in Iran in 1938. He worked for the Shah's regime, was imprisoned when the Iranian Revolution ousted the Shah, escaped over the border to Pakistan, and eventually found his way to the United States, where his wife and children already were. But we are not there yet in the story. You are in an Iranian prison, and on a regular basis, you're being marched into court with other prisoners. And at the end of the day, people are sorted into two groups. The people who go to the left because their guilt or innocence or sentence has not yet been decided. Their case isn't over.
Yes, ma'am.
And then the people who go to the right, who you say are then executed. How did you know that they were executed?
2 days later, they were distributing the local newspaper to us, and we will see the picture over there. And sometimes they bring, for example, a watch from somebody that, do you know this guy? Because we are, do you know his family? This watch we take from him, or this ring from them. You know, they take the guy, you know, he had the ring, was married, you know, ring, and we knew. But they publicize this very openly, and you will see in newspaper all these bodies half naked with a bullet on their bodies, and we knew that unfortunately they have been executed.
And you, for some reason, didn't get executed, but you were interrogated and you were tortured.
Yes.
What can you tell us about what you went through?
Well, you know, the question they ask you a question. First of all, you know what they do. They keep you two in a room for interrogation, and they, for example, one time, you know, one of these investigators hit my head against the wall, and I was really passed down, you know, and because I ask him a question. He said, you know, why don't question, you know, and they insulting you, and they try you that you were this and you were that, and they try to really put you down as much as they could. Morally, they would try to put you down to make sure that, you know, you are telling them or you are hiding something from them. And I couldn't convince them, because these interrogators, they were not educated, they were not knowledgeable.
What did they want from you?
They wanted me to, for example, what Henry Kissinger told me, for example, when we were bringing Americans to work in Iran. I was co-chairman of the Iran-U.S. Technical Cooperation Committee when Kissinger was Secretary of State, and we were helping Americans to come to Iran. Of course, I issued maybe 60,000 work permits for Americans, and maybe out of them, 10 of them was from CIA or 100 from CIA. They said, well, you were working with CIA because you brought all of these people in. And no, I even didn't know if they are, because, for example, when Northrop Page, like, for example, Halliburton, they bring people, B.F. Goodrich, they give us the list of their employees. These are with the degrees. This is engineer, this is engineer. I signed the work permit for them. I didn't know they are working for CIA. In fact, the gentleman who was from embassy was talking to me and coming to my home. He was introducing himself as labor attaché. Later on in Germany, I met him. He said I was one of the major players in the CIA. I said, why you told me you're labor attaché? This is how American, and I didn't know. Maybe I was too naive. I didn't know that the gentleman, you know, Mr. Haas, who was coming to our house, or coming to my office, as introducing himself as labor attaché, he was agent of CIA. I didn't know that.
So you are saying that you had no secrets to give up.
No.
And they were torturing you for,
because they
essentially
know, maybe I know, because with all my position, all my trips, all my traveling, with all delegation that I was head of those delegations in different countries, probably I had relationship with MI6, I had a relationship with the intelligence service, France, Germany, CIA, but no.
So one day you're let out of prison. Why?
Prison was overcrowded. You know, there were so many. When there had a president in Iran whose name was Banisadr, who is now in exile in Paris, he became against Khomeini. Therefore, during that time, they arrested many of those people who were working for Khomeini, about Mujahideen. And the prison, they had no room. They look at us, they see maybe we are not harmful, you know, we cannot create any harm, we are old government employees. They let us go with a bond. And one of my friends put a bond for 1 million tomans, Iranian rial, and I get out of prison.
What would that be in U.S. dollars back then? Do you
about
know?
$100, $100,000.
Okay.
Yeah.
Get out of prison, and then you decide you're going to get out of the country.
Yes, because when I saw in prison, I said, my God, it is so dangerous. If this time I go there, because they needed to intimidate the public, to say, okay, don't stay in front of us. Look at this, how we execute these people. Every day in newspaper, there were 30, 40, 50 bodies of the people who were really high generals, you know, ministers, governors, you know, employees of the Savak. They randomly kill these people from cities, villages, and put all of them in the front page of the paper.
Did you think that you were going to die?
Well, this was an alternative. I'm a very optimistic person. I tell you, one of the reasons that I'm alive and sitting in front of you is I'm always believing tomorrow is a better day. Always. I'm very optimistic. And I was, even in my letter to my wife when I was in prison, I said, soon I'm going to have wing and flying over these. And my wife thinking that maybe they drugged me.
You were able to send letters to your wife
from prison?
She knew that you were alive.
Yes, in prison.
But she didn't know. if you were going to make it out.
No, because, you know, I was sending the letter. They would send us once a month. They would send us to give us a letter to Ivar, and they would read it, all of it, and have to be careful. Therefore, my letter was very, very funny for her and for the children. I want to give them courage. I said, soon I'm going to have a wing and fly over these walls and come and see you.
And so you had friends in high places because of your earlier diplomatic work and your work within the Iranian government. So you were able to get someone to help you get a fake passport?
Yes, ma'am. I get a fake passport with my picture and different name and with a car of the diplomatic car of a consul of the Pakistan in Zahedan. I drove to the border in front of the guard.
How long did it take you to get to the border?
About 30 minutes.
Okay.
From Zahedan. Okay. 30 minutes. We went to Mirjave, and I went there over there, and the Pakistani people over there, they are waiting for me. They put me in a car with two drivers, and 48 hours we drove in the desert, when in fact Taliban was fighting Afghanistan. Russian pro-government of Afghanistan, and we went through this horrible, really. It is easy to talk about it, but it is horrible to go. This 48 hours for me was maybe about 10 days, 20 days, but we drove all the way from this border to Derenge to Karachi.
And then from Karachi?
I went to American Embassy. I told them, this is my passport, but this is not me. This is my name. I work with this guy, or with this guy. I know Mr. Helms. I know this Mr. Sullivan. I made all the name. They said, well, you have to sit down here. They gave me a coffee. They brought me some cookies. I'm sitting there. They went there. They came back. They sent telex back and forth, and they said, well, we cannot really find if you are what you are telling me you are. All the information is correct. But what we would like to do, go to your hotel. Tomorrow morning, we are coming. We pick you up. We take you to the airport. We fly you to Germany. They fly me to Germany. In Germany, I think one of the agents from American consulate, they came, pick me up. They put me to one of the hostels that they have in Frankfurt, which is really 20 room and one bathroom, one kitchen. I stayed there. Then 3 days later, the gentleman, Kenneth House, who was the labor attaché of embassy, came and said hello. And said, how did you know I'm here? He said, well, I know. We went to Hotel Intercontinental, have a lunch. And he said, I said, what you were doing? He said, you were labor attaché. He said, no, I was telling you. Now I have to confess that I was one of the top agents of the CIA in Iran.
Captors were interrogating you then on solid information.
They knew that this guy was coming to our house, but I didn't know that he was a CIA.
Did you really not know that?
No.
Okay.
Because he was interviewed at the labor attaché. How could I? Nobody would tell me.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Fred Nasiri, Iranian-American, Wilmington resident, owner of the Gallery of Oriental Rugs in Wilmington, full disclosure, and underwriter of WHQR. So you've made it to Germany. You eventually get to the United States. At this point, your wife and kids are already in the U.S.
That's correct.
They are in Arkansas?
Fayetteville, Arkansas. Yes.
Fayetteville, Arkansas. Why Arkansas? How did they get there?
Yeah, I think my wife didn't have money. They didn't have money. My brother was helping them to some extent, and they had to go to somewhere which is inexpensive. And one of her brother going to the school in Arkansas, in the University of Arkansas, doing architecture. Then she decided that is maybe least expensive area, a little bit more remote, not exposed to the big cities like many of the militia, or probably what, to safety of the children. And
so part of it is safety, because you aren't even 100% convinced that you're safe within the United States.
No, in fact, because when I went there, in fact, with the help of Henry Kissinger and Robert Kennedy, I got a document to come to America as a political refugee.
Mm-hmm. You eventually come to Wilmington. And now, is this true that the Ghadarzis, the brothers,
yes,
who run two different businesses, vein clinics,
that's good,
they are relatives of your wife? They are your in-laws?
Yes, they are married to, I think, the Cameron and Hormoz. They are brother of my wife.
So how did all of you wind up here in Wilmington, North Carolina?
Okay. After I worked in France, was when I, you know, my mother-in-law was sick and my father-in-law, both of them. And my wife really dedicated her life to taking care of her mother and her father. And Hormoz and Cameron, Hormoz was training, and Cameron was in Texas, and my wife was the only one who was available to come and take care of the parents. Therefore, she came here to take care of the parents. And we end up to be here, you know.
And that was...
Now, my wife came here in 1983, stay here, enter. But I, at the same time, I was working in France, and I was sending money, because I was managing a big factory who was making ball valve for oil industry in South.
And you'd
of
had
France.
To start over. You left all your wealth and your property
nothing.
In
I
Iran.
Had, I had nothing. They confiscated everything.
Yeah.
They took even my inheritance from my father. They took everything we had. But anyway, God bless America. Here, they gave us opportunity. I came here. We all are very successful. You know, the most important person successful in our family is our son, our younger son. He wrote a software with his company, and he sold it for $70 million. You know, it only happened in America. He's young, and he's very successful. He's 4 years now under, of course, what you call a non-compete agreement. He will be over in 1 year, and he starts. His name, Sean, is a very brave person, very hardworking person. I'm very proud of him.
And so you've been able to build this incredible life here and build a community. And when you look back at what's happening in Iran, you know, you talked earlier about the drone strike that killed Soleimani, and that was such a controversial event. But you have a very specific view of this. You think Soleimani should have died.
100%.
Why?
Because this man was coming to Baghdad to go to take American embassy. Because when I put together the information, when I see that Kayhan newspaper said this was our first attempt, watch for our second attempt, and then Soleimani land in Baghdad, they were planning to mobilize 10,000 people, go take American embassy down. I have no doubt about it. Maybe there is some information, maybe Trump knows it, maybe the government, they knows it, maybe they don't want to tell him, because maybe the source of this information might be punished. They don't want to disclose that source of information. But I have no doubt that he was, because he said even many times that, Trump, I'm going to take care of you. And he was a man that he was dangerous guy. I think his record speaks for himself. He was not a general. But these are all in Google. You know, you don't have to really go ask CIA to give information about Mr. Soleimani. Mr. Soleimani's information is open. Everybody knows what he did in Associated Press, to that how many villages he destroyed in and look at these Sunnis in Syria, Sunnis in Iraq. They were dancing in the street when they killed him.
And you also say that it was a good move for the U.S., for President Donald Trump to take the U.S. out of the Iranian nuclear agreement.
100%.
In 2018.
Yes.
And this is about you separating Americans' perception of the Iranian government from the Iranian people.
Yeah. Yeah, Iran has all the know-how of atomic bomb. You know, a country that he says, we destroy America, we destroy Israel, and always, you know, expanding the terrorism. And after this deal, and they get it, $1.8 billion cash, they did more.
And that is this edition of Coastline. Fred Nasiri, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me to be here.
Coastline's production team is Rachel Keith, Ken Campbell, and Marissa Castrino. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, or find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Thank you.